Leaders Questions with Stuart Lancaster. Thanks to Cisco Systems at Exertis Ireland, providing a secure, intelligent platform for digital business. To hear more, visit intelligentit.ie.
This podcast is brought to you by Cisco Systems and Exertis Ireland. WebEx is a suite of solutions that knows what work should be. Intuitive. Don't believe us? Over 70 billion minutes of great ideas happen on WebEx every year. To hear more, visit intelligentit.ie. All right, you're very welcome along to Leaders Questions with Stuart Lancaster. Our guest today is Owen Eastwood, who's a lawyer who's put together an illustrious career in the sports realm, but who's also worked as a consultant with some of the biggest teams in world sport, NATO Command, and multiple other organisations around the creation of culture. Before I get to Owen, you guys have worked together, obviously, so that's this is somebody you have an intimate knowledge of his working life.
Yeah, no, Owen and I go back a fair way, certainly to my time with England, and Owen was hugely instrumental in helping me set up and develop the culture and identity while I was in charge of England. It actually started where I think Owen was on a... I think it's right, Owen, I'm saying you're on the board of Leaders in Performance, and he recommended me to do some cultural leadership stuff with Leaders in Performance, which is a company in England. And on the back of that relationship, our relationship grew, and then I invited Owen in once he'd explained to me the work he'd done with teams. With the England team, and it went from there.
Oh, and what kind of stuff would you do with a team like England? How does that actually work?
It really depends on where the coach is at and building the environment and the culture. Stuart came in as the England coach and had a really very clear focus that he wanted to build this identity, what it was to be English and what it was to wear that shirt. And I think that's what great teams do. It's very, very clear, and it's quite emotive. And that was a starting point, because I'd had a similar exercise with the South African cricket team in 2010, where very talented team, but hadn't really captured what it was to be a South African, what it was to represent the country, and all their different backgrounds. They hadn't really come together around one shared identity. So
This comes back a little bit to the conversation that we've been having about the why. Why do people do things? Why do people buy into a team ethic? Why do they want a shared outcome? And once you begin to answer that question, a lot of stuff seems to fall into place.
Yeah, and it's a thing that often that teams miss. You know, they talk about what they're going to do and how they're going to do it, but never talk about the reason why playing for this team is special. And it's just starting with the why. And there is a book on that. I think from my point of view, you know, that sort of sense of culture, identity, you know, in your team, whether it's a sporting team, a business team, it's absolutely critical. I mean, I go back to my teaching background, and I remember being sat in like teacher training days, and you were desperate to talk about the reason why we'd all come here to work hard for Kettlethorpe High School, which was my school. We never actually got to that. We actually only ever talked about the next inspection or the next bit of paperwork we had to do. And I think it was missing at that point, and it was something I learnt along the way.
Oh, and we'll come back to some of the specifics about how you go about defining the why and making sure that everybody has buy-in to it. But maybe tell us a little bit about your own background, because I'm always interested to find out when people begin to realise that leadership is something that they're particularly interested in, and that it's something that you want to spend your life or spare time or however you actually end up getting into it. So what is your background?
Very unconventional, I would say. I grew up in New Zealand, became a lawyer, studied at university, became a lawyer, came to the UK like a lot of New Zealanders in the late 1990s for a two-year experience, and I've been here pretty much ever since. I got into the high-performance space purely by accident, really. I was practicing as a lawyer. Saatchi & Saatchi were doing a big project sponsorship of the All Blacks, and I was basically asked by the CEO to come in and play a role in that. And I was a lawyer in the UK for a number of years. And when I looked at this review that was being undertaken by Adidas, it seemed to me that the big thing missing from the exercise was a real explanation of what makes the All Blacks special. And that, to me, is actually the culture. Is very, very inspirational and powerful and sustained from one generation and one team to the next. So I got into that, and then just word of mouth in that industry. I got approached by Chelsea Football Club, and the South African team and NATO and Manchester City and other teams after that. So I think that's probably indicative that people know that culture is critical, and they're looking, maybe they're looking for a slightly different point of view on it rather than the traditional management consulting approach.
Did you stop being a lawyer at any point? I mean, maybe Stuart's always a teacher and maybe you're always a lawyer no matter what happens, but are you still practicing as a lawyer or is this now what you do full time?
No, I don't practice as a lawyer anymore. I do this full time and I've been doing it full time for about 3 years. Got to the point where there's too many exciting projects going around to do it part time. So, yeah, I'm pretty passionate about it. And I suppose one thing I'm very fortunate is I work with, you know, three or four teams at the same time, which is a bit unusual, and therefore they've all got different challenges, whether it's World Cups or tournaments or competitions. I also work with some business executive leadership teams, and it's fascinating to see different leaders in different contexts and how they approach the challenges they've got. So I think that's one of the things teams enjoy about me, is that I can bring in some contemporary different perspectives.
Most people happy enough for you to share details? Like, I would assume that there's a lot of intellectual property involved in trying to build what your core leadership strengths are in your leadership group, but when you're working with a bunch of different clients, are you happy enough to share, and are other clients happy enough for you to share in that environment?
I talk to my clients and see where they're at with that. Some of them are pretty open and others less so. But, you know, I don't have any profile on social media. I don't. This is actually the first interaction I've had with the media.
Look who I made him.
Yeah, because of my relationship with Stuart. So I tend, you know, people know I'm pretty discreet, and therefore there's, you know, there's high levels of trust, which is essential because you're dealing with the most intimate problems and challenges and relationships you can imagine. So it's very important that you honour the trust that's given to you.
Can I ask you a little bit about that first project then with the All Blacks, and you talk about the culture. What period are we talking about here? Is this before they've won the World Cup or after they've won the first World Cup? Second World Cup, obviously.
That project was before they won the 2011 World Cup. So it was, yeah, Adidas just carry out periodic reviews of their sponsorship, like all sponsors, and that was just one of the ones in between the 2007-2011 World Cup cycles. So it wasn't at a moment when they were the world champion. That's one of the great things about the All Blacks culture, is that it doesn't just chop and change. There are some very continuous aspects to it that are maintained in each generation of leaders and captains, etc., trying to improve upon it. But there are some things that you could say go right back to 1905. And I've talked about a lot is my background is part Maori, and also half Irish. So my mother is her family are from the Inch Peninsula in County Kerry. So we have a lot of family there. And then on my father's side, he was part Maori and part English. And Maori have a particular view of the world where they see themselves as an individual as part of an unbreakable chain of people back to the very first ancestor and into the future to the end of time. So you always see yourself as part of this unbreakable chain of people, arms interlinked with those who come before you and those who come after you. So for me, that would be my parents interlinked arm in arm with them, but then I have two children and that's how I see myself in the world, is linked to them as well. And the key thing about Maori culture is that your job in life is really to inherit, understand what it is that's come before you in terms of culture. So what are the standards, what's our identity, what's our purpose, who are our heroes, what's the myths, what rituals do we have? It's to understand those, and then when your moment is in the sun, to live to that standard and to uphold that culture, and then critically to pass it on to those who will come after you. And that is actually the complete template, I think, for the All Blacks culture, is that going back to their very first teams, there's been this sense that the shirt is passed down from one team or one player and one generation to another. But not just the shirt, all the storytelling and the power and the high standards and all of those go with it. So they've created some powerful rituals around how they do that. And that's where you have a multiplier effect, I think, in terms of your identity.
It's pretty powerful stuff when you think about it being a multi-generational thing that's layered on over the rugby talent. And it's a remarkable culture to be a part of.
Yeah, I mean, I think, take Leinster as an example. You know, part of what makes Leinster's success, you know, in as we sit here now, is what's happened in the past. You know, it's the coaches, the great players who've played for Leinster. And, you know, if you take that analogy that Owen's talked about there, you know, of the moment in the sun, this is the moment in the sun for this team at this moment. But there's a new generation of Leinster players who are beginning to break through, your Gary Ringroses, your Jordan Lamas, et cetera, et cetera. And young lads who perhaps haven't even broken into the senior squad yet. And their time, the sun is just beginning to move on to them. And that's why teams like, you know, Leinster, Munster, etc., that's why they're always going to be successful in the long term, as long as you maintain that sense of identity. And I've always said since I came here, I've not met a team with so many homegrown players. You know, there's probably 90% of the team are from this area. And that helps as well. And I think Owen, you know, was obviously learnt a lot from his experiences from New Zealand. I guess the key thing, Owen, I'd be interested to ask you, and I think the people who are listening would be interested to hear, is so what would be your philosophy on how you go building a long-term high-performing team? You know, what would be the building blocks do you think are essential for that to happen?
Well, I'd start by an insight that some people get blown away by, and that is there's a guy, Pete Lindsay, who is a psychologist who works with Manchester City, who's consolidated a number of psychology studies around the world, and he has an insight that 70% of our behaviour is determined by whatever environment we're in at that time. So I think most people would probably think 80 or 90% of our behaviour is anchored into who we are, and a little bit is variable depending on our environment. But actually, the studies are the complete opposite of that. And I think that probably makes sense, that if the three of us were to go to the pub, we'd probably have a 70% shift in behaviour pretty quickly. If we then had to go to a board meeting, we might well have another 70% change. And I think so if our behaviour is determined by our environment in such a massive way, then if I'm a leader, I'm waking up first thing in the morning thinking about my environment, not my balance sheet. So that's the starting point, is that there's a famous quote, Peter Drucker, around culture eats strategy for breakfast. I personally don't agree with that, because my point of view is that the building blocks of a great high-performing team are, first of all, a sense of purpose. This is who we are. This is the impact we have on the world, and this is what we want to do together. And then from that purpose, we create a vision. And, you know, Wayne Smith with the All Blacks talks about are a vision-driven team, and I think most elite teams are. They have a vision of what they want to do and how they want to do it, and it's beautifully explained to everybody, and everyone buys into it, and that's what motivates them. And then once you've got that vision of what you're trying to achieve, then you build your strategy, which is just a plan as to how we're going to bring that vision to reality. And then, to me, culture is the next bit, and that is, okay, we've got a purpose, we've got a vision, we've got a plan. So what behaviours do we need by our people in order to make this come to reality? In our high-performance sport, some of those behaviours are around incredible sacrifice and hard work and mental resilience and things like that. But in a business environment, you know, I was a partner in a law firm for a long time, and there are high-performance behaviours you need there as well, just and quite similar, actually. So that's what culture to me is. It's you sit down with me, as you've done, and tell me what the purpose of the team is, the vision that you and the team have created, your strategy, and then we get very specific about what are the behaviours we want to build, and then we create an environment to promote those behaviours. So as an example, again, with the South African cricket team, we created that sense of identity there to drive the culture, but it's all based around very specific behaviours you need to win test matches and win ICC tournaments. You know, it's not just a nice feel-good thing. It's actually very, very engineered around. This is an environment where we have people who can perform under pressure, And actually, just what that involves for them is not people, leaders yelling at them, putting fear into them. It's the complete opposite. Those players perform best under pressure when they feel they belong and they feel cared for. So that's the type of culture that has been built around them, which is, you know, similar to your philosophy.
Yeah, I think one of the things we spoke about as well, one of the challenges of that South African one was the different religious beliefs and the demographic, you know, where they came from. How did you try and pull all that together for that particular team?
Yeah, and this is actually possibly an area where business can maybe look at sport a bit more deeply. Is diversity is seen in sport as a massive competitive advantage. So there's been a lot of studies. I think Princeton, Michigan University, also McKinsey's have done studies which show that a diverse team in terms of problem solving and idea generation will outperform a homogeneous team, even if the homogeneous team has a higher IQ on average. So if you just think about that, you're going into a high performance challenge, you see diversity as a real opportunity, a massive opportunity, because we've got different perspectives, different personalities, different ways of looking at things, different stories and experiences bringing to the table rather than sort of one general way of looking at things. So with South African cricket team, six different cultures and religions in the top 11 players. And what we found when we started with is that because the leaders hadn't created an identity, which we spoke about earlier, each player had their own sense of what they were playing for and it wasn't joined up. So if you were an Afrikaans guy, you'd have a view of what you were playing for, and it might even be a continuation of an all-white sort of archetype of the team before the end of apartheid. Might have been the case for some. If you were a Muslim or a black player, you'd have a different idea of what you were playing for. So to me, when you've got diversity, the first thing you must do is create something that everybody can step into and share. So you have to create an identity that everybody feels part of, and that's what we did. And we spent 3 days in the bush basically breaking it down and building it up again around what is it to be a South African. No matter what your background, what some of the beliefs that we share, and what are the out of that we were able to define some values that no matter what your background or religion, you would agree with. And that was things around like wanting to be creative and adaptable, wanting to be, the idea of honesty was critical to everybody, and the idea of resilience, very important as well. And the protea itself is a flower that when there's a bushfire, it is the only vegetation that regenerates itself. The seed is fireproof, so whenever there's adversity or fire, it's the first thing that regenerates. So that's a great story for resilience. So we started to bring in things like that. So with that diversity, definitely two things were critical. One is we created a shared identity, not a white identity or any other identity, just a shared identity that they could all be part of. And then secondly, we got every player, one or three at a time actually, to sit in front of the others, and we asked them to share the story of their backgrounds, where they came from, when they first played cricket, what playing for South Africa means to them. And that's become a ritual now for all new players who join the team. So with diversity, what you find is that it's natural for us to look at people's differences when we first meet them. And we can only really break through that once you start seeing them as a human being. So a lot of high-performance environments don't do this because people are nervous about the emotion that can come out. But to me, it's absolutely critical that we actually build trust by getting to know each other as human beings. And you know, I've seen in the South African cricket team where there are Muslim players in the dressing room praying towards Mecca, for example, on a Friday prayers, and all the other players are just getting up, going to the locker, walking around them. Isn't there no drama at all? That wouldn't have been the case before the cultural reinvention happened, but now everyone just understands each other so well and respects each other so much and knows, looks at each other as and it's very, very powerful. And, you know, as you can see, they are probably a performing team, given their resources and the way that the international cricket structured in favour of the top three countries. Mm.
Did this all ring bells for you when you were thinking about the future of England when you got the job? And is that why you turned to somebody like Owen?
Yeah, I think I was on that route. I mean, in my so my first coaching job as a head coach was with my team, Leeds. And so I'd been been a player there, I'd been the captain there, I'd been the academy manager there, I got the job as the head coach. So that sense of identity and that reason why was absolutely inside me. So I spent the pre-season, particular pre-season, we'd been relegated and all the players had left. So there was only 7 players left. So we had the promoted academy players and we signed 25 new players. So complete is different context to what Owen's saying, but similar scenario where everyone's from different backgrounds. They're not from Leeds. They've got no sort of sense of identity. And I just spent that pre-season less so talking about scrums and lineouts, more about actually this is what Leeds is about. This is the team. This is the history of the team. This is where it's come from. This is when the club was formed. And these are the former players. And these are some of the stories that we do. And these are some of the things that we do together when we're Leeds players. And so that taught me, you know, a very valuable lesson. And that team, actually, we managed to get promoted at the first hit, really, which we needed to do because we had a parachute payment. And if we hadn't done, the club would have folded. And I'm absolutely certain that some games we won almost because of the spirit of the team rather than actually the technical ability of the team. Yeah. Although, interestingly, a lesson learned for me was the first game where we'd spend a lot of time on this and actually we'd probably overdone it. And the desire to want to do well for the team probably overcame the performance, and we were on the other side of the curve in terms of emotionally, and we underperformed at the time. And I remember the captain, who was a really good leader, Stuart Hooper, who's at Bath now, and he said... I don't know what it was, I felt exhausted, and I think, you know, I'd emotionally exhausted them, really, so there is a balance. So that started it for me, and obviously, you know, during 2011, 2012, 2013 with England, you know, I was doing similar kinds of things, but I just felt I needed a little external help to help me piece it all together, and that's where Owen came into the equation.
The sequencing of it, almost.
Well, I think I had the sequence right in my mind. I just need more help with the technical detail of the identity, and you know, Owen's without talking about him while he's there. You know, he's an unbelievable historian as well. I mean, he could tell me the history of England better than I could. So his ability to research the former, and he went and met former players and spoke to former players, and he got the stories of what it meant to play for England, and we created a history wall and all these little things, you know. And so he helped massively in the, because I was flat out doing the day job.
Yeah.
You know, so I just needed someone else to help me pull that piece together. And Owen was brilliant with it. And we created a film about what it means to play for England, what it means to be English. And that was probably the final piece of the jigsaw, Owen. I don't know if you'd agree.
Yeah, no, I think that was a pretty powerful film, and definitely had a big impact on the players, didn't it? They wanted to keep watching it, you know, before test matches. I remember that. It wasn't just a one-off production.
Yeah. Owen, that the point about history, just reading a little bit about some of the work that you've done, before New Zealand played England in Twickenham, you did some research on somebody who'd fought in the Great War, the First World War, from New Zealand, had been at the 4 biggest battles in the First World War, had ended up being sent home with shell shock, and his recovery came through rugby. He ends up being on the Invincibles team, I think, that tours this part of the world. And you use that history from way back then to help inspire Richie McCaw and his team. And it kind of goes to the point that knowing your history is important so that we don't repeat the mistakes of it, but it's also important so we actually feel connected, like, you know, that arm-in-arm linkage that Richie McCaw must have felt when you told him that story.
The All Blacks have a very, very... Their culture helps them feel connected to the teams that came before them. I'm sure Richie McCaw would be able to reel off number 7s going back to 1905, probably most of them, and a lot of players would be able to do that. So, yeah, that's slightly exaggerated. In terms of how that was reported, you won't be surprised to hear. But yeah, Son White is someone who went to the same school as me, someone I was interested in. And yeah, I brought it to their attention, but I hardly think it was the centerpiece of their team talk. But I think an interesting thing about Son White is that, you know, leadership groups, which is maybe something we might talk about a little bit, but you know, leadership groups are seen as some fantastic modern sort of enlightened invention from coaches. This Sun White story is a good illustration. In 1924, when the All Blacks came on their boat to the United Kingdom for the Invincibles tour, they had a player leadership group. And not only did they have a player leadership group, on the boat on the way over, the captain, Cliff Porter, got each of the players a couple of days to prepare, but they would sit in front of the rest of the team and explain to them what they saw as the critical elements of their position, and that would be followed by a team discussion. So it was recorded how George Nepier was only a 19-year-old All Black fullback, and he wasn't really necessarily that articulate in describing what a world-class fullback might do. So the players just worked with him in the discussion and actually built up a picture of what it was. But then the players also shared with each other what their vision was for the tour, what they wanted to achieve personally and for the team. And you know, that's like nearly 100 years ago. So when we talk about leadership groups, some teams I work with have never done it before and introducing it. The All Blacks can point back at least that far and said it's always been really part of the way we've done things. And that's where you start getting these sustained culture. And actually, just talking about history, one other thing I would say is Munster, 1978, and I was a 10-year-old, and that was an absolute moment I'll never, ever forget. And when we talk about the All Blacks' history, it's not just the All Blacks' history. Other teams' history is interwoven into their history. So the All Blacks have an absolute massive respect and affection for Munster, because in 1978, our stories became intertwined with each other and will be forever. And, you know, sorry to talk about them too much, Stuart, but, you know, that is a part of All Black culture and history, and there's never a team, I imagine, that comes to Ireland where that isn't explained to them, because we must pass down our stories if we're going to learn from them. And that was a good example of the All Blacks playing against a team which were completely inspired and completely deserved to beat them.
Do you remember that? Just as a matter of interest, because we don't actually get the New Zealand perspective on that 1978 game too often. Do you actually remember it as a moment in New Zealand rugby history?
I do, yeah. I was, as I said, I was 10. It was a midweek game. Woke up in the morning to hear the result. And I'm from Southland, and we had a couple of players on the field that day, which made it hurt even more. That was our first Grand Slam tour, in fact. So that was the first time the All Blacks had been to the UK and beat all four home nations. But that was the one game on tour that they lost. So you never, ever forget that.
No harm bringing it up. Well, talk to me then a little bit about leadership groups, since it's come up. When did you start using them? How effective are they? Have you seen them not work?
I think it depends very much on the maturity of the group as to how quickly you evolve them. And, you know, sometimes in teams, I think that as a head coach, you need to provide direction and leadership from the outset. So the order of events in my mind, in a very simplistic form, would be, you know, as owners talk, get the culture and identity right, get the behaviours of the players right that are in keeping with the culture and the identity. Then you get behaviours and standards, and then you get ownership from the players, and then the players begin to lead the team, which is ultimately what you want as a coach. So I think, you know, like I say, if you've got a relatively young team or a newly formed team, I think it often needs a lot more direction from the top in terms of the leadership, and you bring people with you. You know, if I take Leinster as an example now, you know, the leadership group is mature, it's experienced, it's got good people in, they own the culture, you know. So in the lead up to big games, you know, Leo's role and my role and Gavin Dempsey's and John's would lessen towards the end, because they're a experienced team and that leadership group can drive it.
It's an unusual situation though, in that your entire leadership group is gone for two large chunks of the season. They're gone for 5 weeks in November and they're gone for 8 weeks effectively during the Six Nations. So while they're gone, you have to establish new leaders and make sure that the culture doesn't walk out the door with them, and yeah, suddenly you're like, we've got to do it all again here.
Yeah. Which is actually the best thing about that window, because actually you're growing the next generation of leaders. So people like, you know, Ross Byrne or Ross Maloney or or Jameson Gibson Parks had to step up into a leadership role, and these guys have come in and they've grown as leaders. And when, you know, the Allen boys come back in, they think, oh wow, these, you know, it's been good. It's been grand, but we've been away. And so I think it does depend on the maturity of the group. And I think, you know, and I'm just for you really, you know, you've worked with lots of different teams. What would be, you know, the things where you've seen teams who are dysfunctional, what would be the main things that seem to cause teams to break down under pressure? Because everyone can look great in terms of culture and identity in pre-season when things are going well. It's, you know, when the pressure of results comes on, what are the pinch points that people who are listening, who work in teams, should look out for?
I think one thing I've learned over time, and it did take probably far too long, but I've definitely realised it recently, is that, you know, the coach, the coaches, the captain, they're critical. Of course, they are really important for creating that environment, no doubt about it, and setting the standards. And I think in my past, I've probably sometimes looked at that and thought, we've ticked the boxes here, because we've got the captain and the coaches doing the right things, saying the right things. What I've realised over time, though, is that I actually think, and there's some Harvard studies which actually support this idea, that actually the most critical group for success is the peer group. And in a sports team, often what that means is it's a group of players who are influential, not in a leadership role necessarily, often quite senior. And what happens often on a subconscious level is that the coach obviously is going to talk about high standards and all these things, and the captain's going to support it, so we know all that. But what happens, as I said, sometimes consciously, sometimes subconsciously, is the players actually will look at the peer group and see where the real standard is. So if the leaders are talking about sacrifice and the leaders are talking about, great decision-making under pressure and the leaders are talking about trying to refine and those skills and working your butt off doing all that, that's great. But what they're really looking for is, are those group, might only be three or four players, are they buying into this? Mm. Or have they actually got another standard which is a bit below it? And I've noticed in cricket and rugby and football for sure, this happens all the time. So as a leader, you can't just get your captain aligned with you. I think you need to identify who those key influences are in the team and massively make sure that they're on board. And if they're not, get rid of them. And I've seen it happen a number of times where, you know, if I was doing a report, I'd tick just about every box. But actually, in reality, that group of peers, they don't fully buy into it. They are still have some selfishness in there. They're still not going to work 100%. And they are thinking about something other than the present, whether it's next contract or whatever. And that is what affects and degrades the culture. And under pressure, that can fall apart.
This podcast is brought to you by Cisco Systems and Exertis Ireland. WebEx is a suite of solutions that knows what work should be. Collaborative. Don't believe us? Over 27 million minutes of great ideas are exchanged on WebEx every month. To hear more, visit intelligentit.ie.
When people talk about this stuff, it seems really straightforward, you know, and yet, like, so many teams fail to analyse properly or fail to diagnose it when you're in the moment. And you can see why, having somebody come from outside and go, everybody in this side of the room is paying attention, but there's three guys over there and they're cynical about what you're saying. It's important to get that outside perspective sometimes.
Yeah. I don't think it's necessarily you need outside perspective. I mean, you know, a really good intuitive leader should be able to pick up on those signs. One of the limitations a little bit, however, is that people will always say what they want you to hear as the leader. So you've got to delve a bit deeper sometimes by using your assistants or the players themselves and find out where, you know, what's the mood in the camp? Where's the, you know, how is everyone? And always getting around the building and asking those questions, not being stuck in your office where you're only being told what you heard because they walk into your office. Yeah. So I think intuitive leaders should be able to pick up on those things. And just to back up what Owen said, you know, I would categorize it as, you know, there's typically three groups of players: very good professionals who are 100% committed to the course, a group in the middle, and a group maybe who aren't quite there, you know, in terms of the way you need them. If the most powerful personalities are in that bottom group, then that group in the middle will gravitate towards them. And if the most powerful personalities and the people who are selling it and living it are in the top group, the middle group will gravitate to them. And Owen's right, you know, your job as a leader is to influence the top group, to pull the others up to, you know, where they need to be. It's to get to those ones in the middle and say, this is where we're going and this is why it's important you buy into the team first ethic or whatever. And you try with the group at the bottom, but as Owen says, there comes a point where you just go, listen, you know, you're actually the apple that's right in the barrel here. So you're better off cutting them early.
Yeah. Owen, practically, how do you do that? What's the pathway? You said with the South African cricket team, it was 3 days in the bush, and that's obviously hothousing things, literally and metaphorically. But is there a time frame within which change like this can be implemented on a practical level?
Yeah, I've seen a number of situations where problem players turn around quite quickly when the culture shifts to a much more inspirational place to be. Been involved in the team in New Zealand where that's exactly, you know, what's happened recently. So my first thing is, even if it's a problem player with a bad reputation and a few quirky personality traits, don't judge them until you've created a great culture. You know, we talked about it before. If 70% of behaviour is determined by the environment, then I don't think it's fair to have an average environment and expect people to necessarily everybody to be champions. So first thing is, don't look for excuses. Let's try and create a great environment. Once we've created a great environment, then I think we can start judging people. And it becomes pretty simple, really. If they have a net negative effect on the team, then probably better off without them. But I've had coaches ask me, and I've seen it a few times, where they've had world-class players who are disruptive and don't buy into the culture. And that's a very valid debate amongst coaches. What do you do with that? Because, you know Alex Ferguson with Cantona, he accommodated him to an extent and slightly probably varied some of the standards around expectations for him. Kevin Peterson with England for a while, but then they made a tough call that even though he was, you know, a very, very good player, that the team were better off without him. So it's very difficult. You wouldn't generalise, but there's situations where you've got to make a call, but it's a lot easier to make the call when the player's not a world-class player and easily replaceable. It's a hell of a lot harder if they are a world-class player, because coaches are judged in the short term and it's really difficult for them. They want to create a great environment, but at the same time, they need to succeed in the short term, and talent is key to that, no doubt.
Have you seen world-class players cut at the altar of culture and at the altar of the team dynamic, and how has that worked out?
Well, I have seen it, and I've never seen where it hasn't been positive in the medium term. In the short term, the results might dive, but that's where your organisational and team values count for something. I mean, we know what's happening in Australia at the moment. The Cricket Australia have decided that they really need, for the medium and long term, to reinvent the team culture. And some people need to go in order for them to be able to do that, and that's what they're doing. And we can talk about values all day and feel very smug about ourselves, but that's when it's tested. Because are you going to compromise them or not? And you've got to be honest about that. And, you know, I certainly like working with teams where they really mean something. They're not just wallpaper. And if it means something, then you've got to live it. I don't know enough about rugby, really, but people do say with the All Blacks that there's probably two or three players sitting on their sofa every time the All Blacks play a test that could be out there in terms of how good they are, but they just do not fit the culture and the type of player that they believe in. And, you know, that's a powerful example.
What are those decisions like to make?
They are tough decisions. But, you know, you can only make them based on what your value set is as a coach and as a leader. So, you know, I've had decisions like that. I've always wanted to look myself in the mirror and go, you know, if I truly believe in creating a long-term high-performing team, I know I've got pressure to win the short term, but if I'm trying to win and build something that's sustainable for long term, then it's a tough decision, but it's the right decision, there's no doubt. I mean, when I was academy manager at my club, we had a world-class player in our team, literally world-class, and our team wasn't world-class. And he didn't do it consciously, but single-handedly, the culture fell apart around us and the team, and because of the way he was treated differently. So when the boys did weights, he would not do weights. When they would wear suits, he would wear his jeans. When they would have a meeting or a team bonding exercise, he wouldn't turn up. And he was a great player for the team, but it absolutely splintered the team apart. And we were a more effective team the following year with that one player in it.
Mm. I don't know if you're familiar with the Ewing theory. It's Bill Simmons that has made, basically, it seems they come up with this theory over a couple of drinks. But Patrick Ewing was this superstar basketballer, and yet they noticed that every time he was injured or suspended, the team as a collective did much better. And the Ewing theory was born, where your superstar athletes sometimes can actually hold the team back, because in basketball it might be a bit different, that they rely on him, everything goes through him, and that's easier to defend because it's a fairly obvious thing. But there's a cultural phenomenon, really, of somebody being the lightning rod through which the whole team lives or dies. And if that person can't actually carry that, and very few human beings are that amazing that they can, that you're weaker as a result of that.
Mm.
It's not a million miles away from your superstar kid wearing the jeans.
Yeah, it's a high risk strategy to invest all the time into that one person, and you know, it's the strength of the collective, I think, that makes teams effective. You know what I mean? It's making sure you've got a broad leadership group. You know, the media like to narrow things down. Well, who's the captain? And you know, it's never just about the captain. You know, the great teams have got, you know, even if I look at the Ireland team that just won the Grand Slam, you know, it wasn't one leader that did it. You know, it wasn't just Rory Best by any stretch of imagination. And that's a great example of teamwork in action, you know what I mean? It's, you know, the collective was so strong, you know, that they were able to go to Twickenham and win a Grand Slam.
Would you treat that kid differently now, knowing all the, and have with all the experience that you have, would you be able to put him back on a path and say...
Yeah, and I think... I tried at the time. I mean, this wasn't a kid. This was a senior player.
Right.
So he was an international player, and I was the academy manager. So it wasn't. I was observing this happen.
Okay.
In the senior team when I was running the academy. But no. There's definitely been players like that, and obviously the first protocol is not to cut them. It's to try and shape them back into the more. And I think often, you know, different ways to do that. I mean, I end up giving one of the players some feedback. 360 degree feedback, not just from me, but from three or four of the teammates, the physio, the conditioner, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, listen, this is the way you're coming across. You know, it's not just me saying this, that you're not living the values of what we're about. This is what everyone else is saying. It's only when they actually receive that feedback in a constructive way that they've got a decision to make then. Do I change or do I stay? And 90%, you know, if you get the environment right, will change, as Ona said.
Oh, and a lot of people listening will be already in leadership positions, but there'll also be people who want to get to leadership positions. What can they do to train themselves as better leaders and to start thinking about these things in a more long-term way?
I work with a couple of international captains in sport, and we've created a program for them to really develop their leadership capability. And the first thing that we start with, which I think gets neglected, is a massive a bit of reflection on who the hell you are and what you believe in. So I think a strong leader is, you know, and I absolutely include Stuart in that. I think he's an outstanding coach and leader. They have an extremely strong sense of who they are, and they have a sense of narrative of their own story, of where they came from, what they're doing now, and where they're going to go with it in the future. And, you know, one of the things I do with player leaders is I ask them, you know, tell me three bone-deep beliefs you really, really have and where they come from. Because we can all talk about integrity and honesty and hard work, but tell me what are three real beliefs you have, not values, beliefs, and where do they come from? What person or event in your life shaped them? And I think once you start to have some authentic, not reading it out of a book, but develop yourself, these are the things I really friggin' believe in. You know, this is what it is. You know, this is how I want to be every day, and this is the filter I want to use for my decision making. And this is why, and I know why, because this is the way I was brought up, or I had some events in my life which really brought these into focus. So I think there's a lot of, before you do anything, start really, really exploring who you are and what type of leader you want to be, and create some sort of vision around what that looks like. You know, I think before Stuart would have gone to Leinster, he would have visualized exactly how he would have performed that role and the impact he would have on other people and how he'd go about his business. So that's first thing, is getting some real proper reflection time on who you are, what you would believe in, what you'd die for, and how you want to be judged by others. And then second, I think you need a lot of you need to be able to take feedback. So if people are wanting to become leaders, I think it's important that they both understand a bit about their own personality, and there's lots of tools for doing that, but they also get feedback from people they've worked with in the past, even if it's not in a leadership position, and get them to articulate to them what type of person you are, to what type of leader you are, what type of team player you are. So start building a really strong basis upon who you are, what you believe in, how others perceive you, and then you can start, you know, developing your skills around building culture and building strategy from there. But I think those things are where you start.
That can be painful, taking feedback from others about yourself. It's like, oh.
I think we had that conversation in the first session we did, didn't we? We were talking about the leadership, the feedback I got when I'd said, yeah, I'm not that pace setting. And they're all like, yeah, you are.
Yeah.
Anyway.
It is difficult, though, isn't it? Like, I think that's the whole point about this stuff, is that you've got to continuously work at it, that
yeah,
you never arrive at a point where you're finished.
No. And like, that's just a question for Owen. Just from a personal point of view, Owen, obviously you've left your secure job. You know, you've got a business, you know, that you've set up, and you're doing brilliantly at it. What thing would you say for yourself as a leader that you have learnt most in the last 2 or 3 years since you've taken the step into, you know, the world of leadership?
I think the biggest adjustment for me is when you're a lawyer, you are paid quite handsomely to give advice. So when you're having a conversation, you develop these quite high-level skills of listening, but then halfway into the conversation, you start to drift away really from what's being said and start formulating your analysis and then your advice. So you're in a meeting and you're listening, and then people do expect you to be able to come up, formulate some good advice, often on the spot. And that's trained some absolutely horrendous habits in me, because actually what I realize in my job now is I can't really understand or learn anything unless I'm listening extremely carefully and not thinking about the past or the future, but being really locked in the moment with someone. And so I found that that's been a very big adjustment, to really listen a hell of a lot better and then go away and reflect and then come back with advice. So I think my lawyering hasn't helped me at all around that.
Is there anything you've done with a team where you thought, actually, that didn't work that well?
Absolutely. I mean, the thing about, I think, leaders I respect is that they're prepared to take risks. And what I find is that to build bone-deep trust, which is a Gilbert and Oakes phrase from the All Blacks, you have to connect people in a deep level. And, you know, Wayne Smith himself said that if you want to create a champion team, it's a spiritual exercise. And spirituality is defined as individuals being connected to a higher cause than themselves, but also a deep emotional communion between people. So you can't achieve a deep emotional connection between people, which is going to be survive pressure situations, unless you get to know each other. But what I do find is that often coaches are just scared of it. They don't want the players to feel uncomfortable. They don't want the players to feel annoyed with them. They want to create these great cultures, but they're not really prepared to take too many risks around it. And I've had that happen a few times, and it frustrates me. And I like leaders like you who are bold, and you know that there's value in it, and you know the work has to be done. And the fact of the matter is, the fact they're uncomfortable is irrelevant, because you're trying to make them uncomfortable. You're trying to make them comfortable and being uncomfortable. So if you're with each other and articulating our stories, then I don't think it sets a particularly great tone for what you expect them to do on the field. So I've had a few experiences where teams have and leaders have spoken the right language, but when it comes to doing the real work around building that type of culture, they shy away from it and would probably prefer to have a nice film and some other things like that rather than what I think is a bit more deep. So, you know, your point actually before when we were talking about the superstar players and how the coaches deal with them, you see it in business more than anywhere else, where there are corporate values, there's leaders who talk about who we are and our culture, but they absolutely tolerate people who don't live those things because they're perceived as good performers, generating good money, good relationships with clients, all those type of things. So that's not a sporting phenomenon. That's definitely something in business. And any leader's got to keep asking themselves, you know, am I really being true to what I'm saying, or do I actually put a big asterisk beside our values? Because if you're a good enough performer and you generate enough money and you've got enough important relationships, then you can stay here anyway. Because that's fine if that's what they want to do, but the workers will see through that completely. They see that these aren't real standards. It's sort of very conditional and depends on who you are.
They're just values on the wall if they're not being implemented. Is it easy enough to implement this stuff, like when you sit down with everybody, or is human nature... The uncomfortable players, for example, there are definitely going to be people in a group who think, I don't really want to open myself up emotionally, or I have some baggage that I'm not really ready to share, or I don't really believe in this type of stuff. Like, you have to overcome those people.
I think you've got to do it yourself as the leader first and be prepared to open yourself up in front of the group. And then when they see that you are being open, honest, transparent, you know, talking about things that haven't gone so well, admitting mistakes, I think then you provide the trust for people to go down that route. And also, one of the things I've found, particularly about player development or young players, is that, you know, often they would not speak in a team meeting for fear of saying something wrong or whatever, and or making a mistake in a game, you know, and getting a bollocking in the review. You know, I absolutely make sure there's none of that sort of cynical side of that players can be with each other. You know, and you know the young players can't have their voice heard. So I think when you're shown to be supportive of them, you know, young players and the older players begin to realise actually, you know, is actually consistent here.
Yeah.
And one of the key things I think in leadership is, doing what you say you're going to do to build your own personal credibility. So I think opening yourself up to the group, admitting your mistakes. You know, when I came to Leinster, I was open and honest about, you know, the lessons I'd learned coaching England, you know, and I always like to think that they respected that honesty.
Yeah, that was the last thing really that I wanted to bring up, Owen, was that dealing with failure and dealing with setbacks. And we've spoken about this already on the show, in that the culture in this part of the world isn't particularly forgiving for coaches who have made mistakes. Whereas even, you know, if you look back at the careers of the last two All Black coaches who have won World Cups, they both have fairly big failures on their CVs, but they clearly learn from it. Is there a cultural difference from Australia, New Zealand, the Southern Hemisphere, and this part of the world, or is that just a coincidence with those two guys?
No, I don't think it's a geographical issue. I think in football, you know, this is a massive issue, that is the whole short-termism and the lack of tolerance and the need to scapegoat people. And I think if you just get away from the pressure of sport and think about it, it's a bit mad. You know, people go through these incredible learning experiences. I mean, unbelievable learning experiences when you fail. And to get rid of them and then have another go at exactly the same competition through another cycle without all that rich learning, to me, is just absolute madness. And, you know, and the All Blacks probably took a while to figure that out, but then they learned that, you know, Graham Henry and Steve Hansen and Wayne Smith's learning from 2007 was just extremely rich. But not only did they learn, they had great strategies in place for overcoming, you know, what they'd learned and implementing it, as Stuart would have if he had carried on as England rugby coach. So, you know, it all comes down to, it's all very well having great coaches and players, but you also need good people above them. And a lot of people in those positions are extremely sensitive to media pressure, and don't like to be criticised, and don't like the fans to turn on them, and therefore like to maybe scapegoat individuals. And to me, that's just absolutely crazy. If you've recruited someone carefully, you know them inside out, you know they're a good coach, you stick with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's the absence of leadership in those terms. One of the most important decisions in World Rugby history was the decision to keep Graham Henry on so that he could apply the learnings from getting so close to winning a World Cup and not being able to do it, and then suddenly gets the team over the line. It's like, you know, anybody can't look at that sequence of history and not think, well, there's something that we should all be able to learn from. But I guess...
He's been in Major League Baseball, famous, you know, for through Moneyball, where he says that, basically says that the rarest thing in sport is the discipline to stick to a plan. And it's because of the emotional pressure of the market they operate in that most people cannot handle it. And that's actually not talking about players and coaches, that's talking about the people above them. They can't handle the pressure of competing and not succeeding, and they panic and they throw a plan out the window. And I completely agree with them that if you look at really successful teams, multiple competitions around the world, you will see there's some real consistency generally. There's very few examples of the opposite. There's normally great consistency in sticking to the plan and sticking to the people.
He's obviously a very impressive guy. Has a client list that anybody would be particularly interested in. And the experience of working with him obviously was something you found hugely beneficial.
Yeah, yeah. And even, you know, obviously I don't work with him now with any team. I still speak to him, you know, and I'm equally interested in what he's doing with other teams. And obviously, he doesn't tell me everything, but he gives me an insight, and we have a really healthy debate about, do you see this or what do you think about that? You know, and he's quite remarkable, really. You know, his intellect and his knowledge on that area when he was not brought up as a sportsman.
Yeah,
he was brought up as a lawyer, representing sports people. So it's quite, you know, he's unique, really, and you know, he meant what he said there when he said he doesn't do any. This is the only time ever he's come out and spoken publicly about what the work he does.
Yeah,
which is amazing, really. I mean, let's say because I twisted his arm, but and I'm pleased he did, because I hope that people who are listening, you know, he articulates it so well, doesn't he?
Yeah,
and he makes it sound so easy.
Well, that's the thing.
It's not easy, and it is hard. But no, he's very good, very good.
With a lot of this leadership stuff, a lot of it is common sense, but sometimes you just need people to lay it out for you and go, this and this and this together is very powerful. But if you're just doing one of these things and you don't have the rest of it, then ultimately you're not really going to get anywhere.
Yeah, and you get wrapped up in the day-to-day stuff, you know, the business of the days, and, you know, doing the jobs, and just try and keep your head above water. And I think the great leaders are able to step back and find the space in their diary and in their mind to, and then engage the staff or the people who work for them down this route. And it's not all the time, and it doesn't, you know, you shouldn't overdo it, because you know, it's, once you've got it in place, then it's, you know, you've got to be delivering performance, not just talk about culture all the time.
Yeah.
But there's no doubt it's the foundation.
And you can stress check it every 6 months or
exactly.
However long, whatever is a reasonable amount of time,
exactly.
Depending on what the industry is.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right, Stuart, great stuff.
Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by Cisco Systems and Exertis Ireland. WebEx is a suite of solutions that knows what work should be successful. Don't believe us? Over 113 million brilliant people meet on WebEx every month. To hear more, visit intelligentit.ie.
Leaders Questions with Stuart Lancaster. Thanks to Cisco Systems at Exertis Ireland, providing a secure, intelligent platform for digital business. To hear more, visit intelligentit.ie.